we are taking next week off.
Yes.
For Colonial Holiday. And you know what? I'm going to play a song. This is David Morin. And the song title is Same Old Game. You are still listening to Rose City Native Radio.
Program was produced at KBU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KBOO.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host for the hour, Larry Smith. On today's program, the U.S. government's Title 42 program and how it's being used to illegally deport indigenous and non-indigenous asylees and political refugees, the recent North American Leaders Summit held in Mexico City this past January 9th and 10th, plus more in how it impacts indigenous and non-indigenous peoples migrating to the United States. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone through air in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the Bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
Today on American Indian Airwaves, I have the honor and pleasure to speak with Dr. Roberto Hernandez. He's Associate Professor of Chicana and Chicano Studies at San Diego State University. He's actively engaged community-based researcher, scholar, teacher, writer, and activist. His research and publications focus on the intersections of colonial and border violence, the geopolitics of knowledge and cultural production, decolonial political theory, social movements, hemispheric indigeneity, masculinity, and comparative border studies. He is the author of Coloniality of the U.S.-Mexico Border, Power, Violence, and the Decolonial Imperative. Dr. Hernandez joins us for the hour to discuss several crucial issues, including the recent events of indigenous and non-indigenous peoples that are either seeking asylum or political refugee status. migrating into the United States along the U.S. colonial border in the South. He provides us an update of the North American Leaders Summit that was held this past January 9th and 10th and how it impacts Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. And he provides us an update on how the AMLO-Biden meetings signal a red flag to Indigenous peoples and land and water protectors. He joins us to discuss the federal Title 42 program and how it is used as a colonial tool for deportation and managing migratory populations into the United States, and how the detention centers are institutions and locations of state violence violating Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples' rights, and more. We start the interview with his response on President Joe Biden's recent visit to El Paso, Texas, and the Abridge of Americas.
First of all, this visit by President Joe Biden in some ways has been long overdue. It's usually expected of a president to give some lip service and presence on the border. He's been hounded by the Republicans for not visiting the border sooner. But what we also need to not lose sight of is that whether Republican or Democrat, one of the problems with the border is not that there's a border crisis, but that there's a crisis in being realistic about what's happening and actually taking the lead from border communities who on a day-to-day basis are the ones most directly impacted and engaged with these dynamics of migrations, which are themselves, based on displacement of largely Indigenous people in the South. So part of the issue is also that what is often paraded as comprehensive immigration reform that we haven't really had in decades, but nevertheless, this pretension to comprehensive immigration reform has always hinged on two main anchors, if you will, one being pathways to citizenship and the other one being border security. But precedent after precedent, we've seen the border security part that has been definitely strengthened, but yet, a lot of back and forth, first with DACA and now with Title 42, and yet we don't see much results. And for all the claims to the need for more border security in exchange for pathway to citizenship, we've been seeing the strengthening of the border, whether it was going back to the 90s and 93, 94 with several operations, and 2001 after 9/11, we get another major reinforcing of the border. We get Secure Fence Act years later. So the border has been secured, and the border has been increasingly strengthened, and yet there's been no dividend on the pathway to citizenship side. Instead, it's been disentanglement with DACA and now in the context of these asylum seekers, this really cat and mouse game with Title 42, which although Trump-era policy is definitely still being embraced and, given some lukewarm critiques from the Biden administration, but nevertheless, the courts have kept it in place. So I think this is a backdrop then for the visit to the North American summit, right? And when President Biden meets with Mexico's President Andrés López Obrador, that there's this longer context of border enforcement, border security, but also I think one thing that we don't get too much in it for an American audience is that tied to the border are also other mega projects within Mexico, most specifically the Trans-Isthmus Corridor that cuts across indigenous communities in Oaxaca, and the increasing militarization of Mexico's National Guard, both of which are really combining to to be part of a broader package deal of U.S.-Mexico border security really being relocated down to not only the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala as a first line of defense for the U.S., but this trans-Isthmus corridor that, while displacing indigenous Oaxacan communities, Zapotecos, Mixtecos, Triquis, and others, will also form a new kind of border defense. So what we have as far as the dealings between U.S. and Mexico, for as much as there's still this idea that AMLO, that Mexico's president, is of leftist orientation. I mean, in many ways, he's been giving a lot of lip service to progressives, but has really been reinforcing the border on behalf of the U.S., both with Guatemala and with this new mega project that is really being led by the National Guard, which itself was supposed to be formed to deal with corruption and drug trafficking, but has really been mobilized primarily against indigenous communities to safeguard these mega projects of death, as the Zapatistas have been referring to them, the Trans-Isthmus Corridor and the Maya Train as the two primary examples, but other projects as well.
Thank you, Roberto, for that response. And you talked about the militarization of Mexico's National Guard and also the cartels. I was curious the role that they play. And I don't mean just narco traffickers, but cartels' primary revenue source is the trafficking of U.S. military weaponry, human trafficking, as well as the trafficking of drugs or narco trafficking. So how does what is the role of the cartels, and how do they escalate and compound the violence directed at indigenous and non-indigenous migrants traveling to the United States?
Well, they've definitely diversified their portfolios, if you will, right? So it's no longer just drugs, but you're right. I mean, they have their hands in weapon, bringing weapons down from the U.S. I mean, we need to be clear too that those weapons are traveling south, right? It's not just drugs and humans traveling north, but these weapons that are traveling south. And in many ways, the cartels serve as an unofficial wing of these major developments, right? Because they're also trying to control territory. They're also trying to, knowing that these investments are coming, knowing that these mega projects stand to be introduced into some of these very rural mountainous areas, they want to control territory to then also be able to profit off of those developments. So, I wouldn't think it's far-fetched even to conceive of these cartels as kind of like the frontiersmen, if you will, thinking of the processes in the U.S. with Manifest Destiny. Mm-hmm. These are the first line of defense, the first entry point into indigenous territories that not only displace and disorganize and disrupt the daily life and bring fear into people's lives, drive them from their own land for control of territory to then cut the deals with the developers and profit off of that. So they're very much, if not explicitly in line with the development projects, definitely an inadvertent kind of precursor to these development projects. So they do kind of coincide in many ways. And I mean, one thing we've been highlighting, in fact, here at the Centro Cultural La Raza, our current exhibit for Enero Zapatista, which is a month-long series of Zapatista-related events, is a art exhibit highlighting the over 100 land and water defenders that have been killed, and more specifically, an increase in the killing of indigenous land and water protectors under this current regime, this AMLO presidency, which again has been one that has made very superficial claims to being in support of indigenous communities, all the while increasing the violence, both direct and indirect through cartels and paramilitary forces in a lot of Native communities.
And is it fair to say that the systemic violence is an impetus for people to migrate to through Mexico and to the United States? And is this a major contributory factor to the migratory population that we're experiencing right now?
It has historically, although I would say there's been two types of responses. On the one hand, you have had more displacement and migration previously, but increasingly, at least within the Mexican context, especially with the rise of the Zapatista-supported National Indigenous Congress, you increasingly have a lot of communities organizing themselves and arming themselves and taking on the work of being, these armed community patrols that have at some level tried to fend off the cartels, fend off the state, stand their ground and defend their communities. But then they're up against the odds here, and this is also one of the reasons why there's been more deaths. So Mexican migration has on a overall picture has somewhat declined, because there has been an increase in people staying put and defending their territories. This is why most of the recent migrants that we're seeing are coming less from Mexico and more from places like Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, where you have similar processes going on, right, in terms of the types of attacks on communities and displacement, disruptions of not only local economies, but political disorder in the case of Honduras, more specifically, going back to 2010 and a U.S.-sponsored coup that brought down the democratically elected president.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Roberto Hernandez. He's providing us a detailed update on the human rights violations committed by the United States government and other nation states on indigenous and non-indigenous peoples migrating into the United States along the U.S.-Mexico border who are seeking either asylum or political refugee status. And now back to the interview.
There's been some shifts now with a new woman president that was recently elected, and her name escapes me right now. So perhaps a brighter turn in Honduras, but at least the last decade has been, part and parcel of this systemic violence that has been the reason why we have mostly Hondurans and Guatemalans and Salvadorians on our southern border, and to a lesser extent, folks from Nicaragua as well.
You mentioned Honduras, Nicaragua, and I know in the past we've talked about indigenous peoples from Guatemala, and I was wondering if, just based on what you're sharing with us, how much of additional mega projects, if you will, that have gone on and are going on in the countries that you've mentioned, how much of that contributes to creating political refugees? And also, what role does the climate crisis play in this?
Yeah, I mean, in some of these Central American countries, right, the projects have been hydroelectric plants on the one hand, mining projects, and I mean, at the root of this, right, is the unwillingness to recognize that more and more of this type of resource extraction is precisely what's creating the climate crisis, right? That changes in weather are creating uninhabitable situations for various regions, the rivers overflowing, destroying communities. I mean, it's not a stretch to recognize that these refugees are as much climate refugees as they are political and economic refugees. These these dynamics go hand in hand, and you're seeing it, you know, across Central America, but in the case of Central America, I mean, they've also been fairly violent in terms of the types of attacks that have preceded entering into the communities to try to develop these projects. Now, they've been a little bit more unorganized and less coherent or cohesive, if you will, than in Mexico, where in Mexico, it's specifically the newly formed National Guard that has done it in a much more systematic way. But yeah, I mean, these projects run the gamut across Central America.
Yeah, I was just wondering, when we talk about refugees, economic, political refugees, and kind of coming back to the conversation about Title 42, I was wondering if we could maybe unpack that a little bit further in the context of human rights, right? So sorry for our listeners, they certainly, if they're familiar with American mass media performance, hear about what Title 42 is, but maybe you could unpack what that is for our listeners, and then what does that mean in the context of human rights law and like refugee status?
Title 42 was provisions that were first introduced in the context or most recent context of COVID as a public health measure that would, rather than simply allow asylum seekers and refugees into the country, would have them, in essence, be registered and then wait in Mexico until their number is called, if you will, until their case can be heard. Now, the problem with this is that it goes completely against internationally recognized asylum-seeking standards, right? In that, when someone is migrating, not as a regular migrant, but as a refugee or asylum seeker, the whole point of international law is that they are supposed to be allowed into the country seeking refuge, right? It's not like wait outside and we'll decide if we'll give you refuge, right? The point is that these are time sensitive, in many cases life and death situations for many of these people, and to have them go through this extra hurdle of staying in another country that itself is susceptible to violence and can, you know, be very dangerous in and of itself, the folks are being forced to wait. Now, the irony of this, like, you know, it still like doesn't surprise me, though, that for as much as this was a measure that was introduced in the context of the pandemic, you know, you have right-wing anti-vaxxers that are, you know, diehard against all types of COVID restrictions within the U.S., yet here the most expansive COVID restriction that we have, and not a word from these anti-vaxxers and COVID, what would you call it, non-believers? I don't know what the proper word would be. yet Title 42 is never really seen in the light of a COVID restriction, when that's precisely the justification that was used when it was first introduced.
The other aspect of Title 42 is, and I think you are alluding to this in your response, is that the notion of that safe third policy, which requires migrants, right, to apply for asylum in a country through which they transit, right, through. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if maybe you could speak to that and how that undermines their rights that they have as refugees.
So the idea of, again, applying in a third country when, in the case of these migrants coming from Central America, for the most part, that would mean Mexico, right? And again, when the situation is itself fairly unstable in Mexico, it really just adds another obstacle or hurdle. But more than anything, it's and the word escapes me now, but it's almost like outsourcing border management to Mexico writ large.
Gotcha.
That's really, I think, one way that despite even, you know, AMLO's pretty strongly worded critiques of the U.S.'s relationship to Mexico, nevertheless, what is happening in real practical terms is this outsourcing of managing this entire refugee, I hate to use the word crisis, right? Because the refugees are not the crisis, it's the displacement and mega projects that they're escaping from that are the crisis. But all in that to say that this is a broader shift in migration, refugee, asylum-seeking policies, and that it is being outsourced to Mexico, in a context where the state capacity really to deal with this is not fully operational. And that, you know, it's always tricky and difficult to talk about these things because we run the risk of then, you know, reiterating stereotypes of corruption and disorganization in Latin American countries. But let's face it, the state capacity is not operational either in Mexico or the U.S. for that matter. And that's why they're trying to outsource it.
Well, you know, the other I asked about the this particular, you know, safe third country policy, because, you know, if migrating folks don't apply for asylum in which the country they are traversing or traveling through and they make it here to the United States, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, with the Biden administration's kind of expansion, if you will, of Title 42, or reinterpretation of applying it, is that people will be deported or expeditiously removed, if you will, if they legally don't apply for asylum in the country that they traveled through first. And so I was wondering, is that true? Is that your understanding?
Well, yeah, I mean, currently that's the most recent proposal by Mayorkas, is that while they'll be taking in 30,000 from each of, I believe they named about four or five countries, they'll be also removing 30,000, right? So they're trying to play this number game, saying that it'll still be at net zero. But the point being that they're still removing people back to dangerous situations that they're escaping from, right, or trying to escape from. And at the same time, I mean, the countries that were named, you know, in the case of Honduras and I think El Salvador was in it, the other two were Nicaragua and Venezuela. Mm. I mean, Nicaragua and Venezuela, we know, have very different political situations and increasingly more complicated in the case of Nicaragua in terms of it formerly being a leftist country, but hard to really call the Ortega regime a leftist country any longer. But of course, in the case of Nicaragua and Venezuela, it's really more of a political showcase under this idea that they are these leftist countries and that in itself is the problem that people are escaping, right? So we also need to look critically at why only these select countries. Well, we still have Haitian migrants showing up at the border. We still have migrants from other countries as well. But there's always this showcasing, if you will, of what those that are perceived as enemies of the U.S. on the one hand, and then in the case of Central America, there's the other Central American countries. You know, U.S. culpability is at the heart of why they're leaving to begin with. So to send people back to these dangerous contexts on the grounds of not having applied, it really, again, strikes against the heart of international asylum-seeking system to the extent that it has much of a heart, right? And I say that in defense of human rights, human rights regimes not being respected unless it's politically convenient or expedient to do so.
Is it fair to say that when the U.S. is immediately without any sense of due process or in accordance to international law, is violating refugees' political rights? And I'm thinking, you know, of the United States being a signatory and ratifying the international treaty under the 1967 protocol relating to the status of refugees, where it forbids nation states from sending people back to places where their lives and rights are threatened. So is it fair to characterize what has transpired or what is transpiring with the Biden administration with refugees being sent back, that the U.S. is violating not only their rights, but also committing crimes in international contexts?
Yes. I mean, both, not only the conventions on rights of refugees, but when we look at many of who these migrants are, it's also a declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, separation of families. These are even going back to 1951 conventions on genocide. Mm-hmm. I mean, the separation, the conscious, intentional separation of families does fall under the genocide conventions. Mm-hmm. And so these laws, not only international laws being violated, again, the question becomes, you know, what is the enforceability of these laws? Okay. How does the UN or any other international body have any actual teeth to enforce any of these laws? And not just international laws. I mean, we could look more concretely at what's been happening in Texas and Florida with these migrants being sent off by Governor Abbott and DeSantis to the homes of Kamala Harris and others. These are also domestic child trafficking laws that are being broken, kidnapping and false imprisonment. I mean, you could list the whole array of crimes, both domestic and internationally.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Roberto Hernandez. He's providing us a detailed update on the human rights violations committed by the United States government and other nation states on indigenous and non-indigenous peoples migrating into the United States along the U.S.-Mexico border who are seeking either asylum or political refugee status. And now back to the interview.
But again, when it comes to, you know, who are these crimes being enacted on, is there even any political will to think of them and recognize them for the crimes that they are? There is no justice, right, when it comes to those who are being affected by these crimes of, you know, not only contravening the international conventions, but what amounts to outright kidnapping and trafficking even of migrants without their consent, without their knowledge, into, you know, states like New York, New Jersey, and elsewhere, where they have no business being, because, again, many of these aren't even migrants. They're refugee and asylum seekers, which by default is a different categorization and should be dealt with, you know, in a different manner. Right. And yet, you know, we have both the federal government, you know, violating international treaties and international conventions, and we have state governments violating federal laws in the process. But yet, you know, the idea that any of these governors or others involved in this might be referred to attorney generals for crimes I hate to say it, but rather unlikely.
You know, in listening to you and just based in a prior interview that you and I did, when we're talking about indigenous asylum seekers and indigenous political refugees, you know, along the U.S. Settler colonial border and families being separated, is that the last time we spoke, a lot of these families that were separated, members of the Border and Customs Protection, if you will, they did not have appropriate translators. And so a lot of Indigenous children that were separated from their parents were not reconnected back with their parents. And I was wondering, is this still true today with this, you know, with what's happening, you know, over the past year or so?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, they have done a better job of trying to access interpreters.
Right.
But I'm sure, you know, there's definitely people who slip through the cracks, right? I mean,
right.
They don't, you might have, I know in the last year or two, there was a big drive, for example, to recruit mom-speaking interpreters. And so you have access to interpreters of languages that are perhaps more broadly spoken, mom being a Mayan, part of the Mayan family of languages. That's in southern Chiapas and Guatemala. But, you know, you have other languages that are not as commonly spoken, for which, you know, even if they try to find interpreters, you know, might have some difficulty doing so. So, yeah, that continues to be a concern, not only in terms of interpretation and language, but continued separation of families, of children from the families, of detention with I'm blanking here on the term, but long, like detention without an end date in sight, right? Many of the people we've talked to here in the local detention center in San Diego, the Otay Mesa Detention Center, some people there have been in detention for years on end, and don't have dates for when their cases might be heard. Right. So there's also many folks lingering in the detention centers that we forget about, because we're still just looking at the border itself, and those that have made it in and have been put in detention centers, oftentimes spending, you know, anywhere from 8 months to, we've met people who've been in the detention centers going on 4 or 5 years, and still with no anticipated end date.
And I take that's not not an uncommon experience where people in detention centers are held without any sense of due justice or justice, if you will, where they end up being they end up living in detention centers, oftentimes, you know, separated from families and those that they've migrated to the United States with, in part because perhaps their family members fear some, you know, incarceration if they were to visit their relatatives that have been that are being held for years. Is that fair to say?
Well, one of the things is that again, during COVID, there was no visitations, right? Mm-hmm. So Detention Resistance is an organization here in the San Diego area. Mm-hmm. That works with detainees, and whereas previously they had been doing visitations, during the context of COVID, there was no visitations allowed. So it's been only through putting money into commissaries, running hotlines, that we've been managing to get information from detainees on the inside. Mm. And so one thing is, you know, if not only family members can't visit, but also sometimes people don't have family members in the immediate area. Their family members might be in New York, in Pennsylvania, or, you know, in farther locations, or if they have them at all. And so one other dynamic that Detention Resistance has been kind of figuring out about, using just Otay Mesa as a microcosm, if you will, for things that are likely occurring in other detention centers, but increasingly there's also a hierarchy within the detainees not of detainees against each other, but of the detention center workers often kind of looking to indigenous migrants as more docile and more quiet, and therefore putting them to do more intensive labor under the idea that they wouldn't be likely to complain as a someone who has more control or dominance of, say, Spanish or maybe some even some English. So we've had stories of some indigenous women being put in these positions of having to be the ones cleaning the detention centers while they themselves are detained, based on again, not just historic, but contemporary forms of racialization against indigenous communities.
I was thinking of the film The Infiltrators, right, directed by Christina Ibarra and mm-hmm. Alex Rivera, you know, as you were sharing that response. And you're talking about this kind of politicized, racialized exploitation of indigenous people's bodies. And I was wondering if what you're sharing, if that falls in line with what the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is an office of the Administration for Children and Families under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And they estimate that nearly 45% of asylees and refugees living in the United States have experienced some type of torture. So is that, I was wondering maybe you could unpack that for us. Is that within the context of these detention centers, or whether they're privately ran and operated, or even federally operated?
Well, I'm not familiar specifically with those numbers, I have to say, but I wonder if to what extent this is a reference to torture in their countries that they're leaving from, or in the detention centers. However, that being said, right, even if we don't use the word torture, have some of these indigenous refugee and asylum seekers being subjected to harsher punishments, more restrictive practices, and violent responses from the guards? Yes, definitely. There has been a clear indication that they have been on the receiving end of more harsher treatment when in detention, and particularly private detention, though not exclusively.
Well, and I think also too is, and maybe this I was trying to get at, is that, you know, folks that are leaving their home countries because of the different various types of violence they've experienced or are under the threat of experiences, that when they get here to the United States, right, as asylees or refugees, they are met with different forms of state violence, which just would trigger, if you will, or compound not only the violence but the trauma that the families and the individuals experience. And then what are the implications then of the compounded violence, which is often left out of the conversation?
Yeah, and even just, you know, the dealing with these people in uniforms who, when their experience has been traumatizing one, you know, I mean, they are definitely more susceptible, whether or not there's a direct explicit violence rising to the levels of torture. I mean, yeah, it's definitely a form of compounded violence that's gonna leave larger or deeper psychological wounds and damage, if you will. And that we've definitely seen from the people we've talked to from the Old-Time Mesa Detention Center.
In coming back to Title 42 in the context of talking about, you know, various forms of violence, I know Human Rights First, they said they tracked at least 13,000, almost 500 reports of either murder, torture, kidnapping, rape, and other violent attacks on migrants and asylum seekers blocked in or expelled to Mexico under Title 42 since President Biden took office. And I was wondering, is that consistent with the kind of work that you and others are doing? Is this consistent with what you're seeing and your thoughts on that?
Definitely. While obviously here in San Diego, detention resistance is more of a small grassroots effort. And so while we could speak to it anecdotally in terms of the cases and full-time as a detention center, I do think it speaks volumes to these larger patterns that are being uncovered elsewhere, that there is not only really bad conditions that were from, especially during COVID. I mean, we had a major impact there on detainees during COVID, but beyond COVID, I mean, there has been an ongoing question of the institutional violence and in terms of the. There's a term, and I apologize, I haven't had my coffee this morning yet, but a term that detention resistance in particular was using to identify some of these conditions inside the detention centers. But all in all, it comes back to this question that even through the outsourcing to private companies, this is one of the ways that the federal government has tried to wipe its hands clean of any responsibility by, putting it on the GEO group, putting it on these private companies that are running these detention centers. But ultimately, the state is still responsible, whether these are privately run facilities or not. And I don't know if the numbers we could say are any worse under Biden than previously. I mean, there has been some really severe cases that have caught the attention of the federal government and forced them to crack down a bit on some of the private companies and enforce better conditions to an extent.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Roberto Hernandez. He's providing us a detailed update on the human rights violations committed by the United States government and other nation states on indigenous and non-indigenous peoples migrating into the United States along the U.S.-Mexico border who are seeking either asylum or political refugee status. And now back to the interview.
But we did hear from, this was actually, it's been now maybe about a year and a half ago, there was a group of, I believe, about six or seven detention center workers who had been transferred from other detention centers to Otay Mesa, and they came out publicly as whistleblowers, condemning the practices within Otay Mesa Detention Center as far worse than what they had themselves seen in the centers where they previously worked. So there's also, variations from, say, one detention center to another. But nonetheless, when you have the detention center guards coming out and condemning the practices, then we're in a heap of trouble.
And what are some of those egregious practices that have happened and in some cases continue to happen in these detention centers?
Yeah, well, one that did draw a lot of media attention was early on during the COVID, during the pandemic. There was no mask being given unless migrants were being forced to sign deportation orders to be able to receive a mask. People were having to use makeshift masks out of their own t-shirts and the like. People who were noticeably ill with COVID were not being isolated. So then you had massive spreading outbreaks one of the first deaths of COVID-related deaths of detainees occurred here at the Otay Mesa Detention Center in San Diego. You have people being purposely put in to different units, despite knowledge of them likely being affected and so on. Although obviously COVID the COVID numbers have dwindled, I mean, right now we have been looking at a small resurgence and of it in the last month or two. We haven't heard as bad as they were in the earlier period of COVID, but there are still reports of these conditions, of mistreatment, of people being put in isolation that continue to the present day.
So no free prior and informed consent for medical treatment for indigenous asylees or political refugees?
Yeah, for
everybody.
Any of them, yeah. And then the other thing that's unique here to the Otay Mesa Detention Center is that there is also detainees from the marshals, meaning federal criminal detainees, and there also seems to be an attempt to play the marshals detainees against the asylum-seeking detainees, right? Where they're pitted against one another in terms of disparate treatment going towards the two.
As we start to wrap up our interview, I was wondering, when we come back and talk about, the work that you're doing and others, and, we're talking about Title 42 just because it's gotten so much media attention. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, the work that you do, faith-based and other humanitarian organizations or legal workers that you work with who assist asylum seekers, do you find them enduring any kind of violence, being stranded in Mexico, for example, and facing threats and attacks, say, from the cartels or even the National Guard, for that matter?
At least here in San Diego, it has happened. It has, although I would say it's maybe dwindled a bit as the more recent focus has turned to other border cities. But one of the cases here in San Diego, there was at least 42 people, I believe it was, that eventually the ACLU did put in a lawsuit in terms of people that were being lawyers and other sheltered people working at shelters that were crossing the border back and forth. And whenever they would cross into the U.S., they were being sent to secondary, held for hours on end with no logical explanation. But eventually it was unveiled that it was a very specific watch list that was being developed by CBP that was targeting lawyers and other activists for doing this work. There's been a few cases of people working at shelters, that shelters have been raided by not only authorities, but in some cases held hostage by cartel members. Happening, when there was more attention here in San Diego. So some of that has definitely subsided for the most part, but there is still an uneasiness about it in terms of some of the people doing this work, whether these, if it's happened already once before, it was to stop it from happening again, right? So people that would more regularly cross back and forth, mm-hmm. Have definitely stepped back on that. I personally know some friends and colleagues who were working as attorneys supporting many of these asylum seekers who have also suffered not physical violence but outright mental and psychological exhaustion to the mm-hmm. point that they've had to leave this work because of how not only draining but seemingly endless, and especially when you have the constant, changing of the rules of the game, so to speak, those back and forth on yes, Title 42, no, Title 42. I mean, it's exhausting and mentally draining. So I know many lawyers that have quite literally decided to just take a year, 2 years, 3 years break now from doing this type of work because it's just been difficult to sustain.
You talked about, just the work that allies are doing and trying to do, and certainly, the American mass media, uses very xenophobic terminology and phrasing, right? From, as you mentioned earlier, crisis at the border, or using words like surge, flood, wave, invasion. If you watch Fox News, you just sound like there's an invasion happening that's been happening, every day for years. And lost in all that are the people doing the work, like yourselves and other allies, but also, the people, these asylum seekers and political refugees, right, is the fact that these are real human beings and that gets lost in a lot of the American mass media coverage. And I was going to say, is that a fair kind of sanitized characterization? And then maybe just wrap up by talking about the work that Detention Resistance has been and continues to do. And if you have a website or any information you want to provide listeners, please provide that.
I think on the one hand, all the characterizations that you mentioned, but even one that I think is perhaps a little bit more benign, but equally, if not more damaging, is the continued insistence on referring to these folks as illegal aliens, right? When not only, is the term in itself a problem, but many of these folks do not qualify under being undocumented migrants, right? To put it more properly, these are not even undocumented migrants. These are asylum seekers, refugees, for which there exists a different set of rules than would for a migrant, documented or undocumented. And yet there's this insistence on referring to them in the same manner, in a derogatory manner, with the term illegal aliens. So we're still seeing a lot of that playing out. And here, just to conclude with, the work with Detention Resistance, I've been on the peripheries of Detention Resistance, was more directly involved with it earlier on, and now continue to be on the peripheries and supporting their work. But they continue to do the work of commissary, running hotlines, and just recently, COVID restrictions were finally lifted in terms of visitations. So at Otay Mesa Detention Centers, as of about a month ago, I believe, visitations are now able to happen again. So I believe they're starting to get back to the work of trying to be physically at the detention center, taking testimonies from these detainees more directly, in order to continue the work of documenting the types of conditions that they're being held under, and where possible, trying to do the work of connecting them with family members and with legal support. Detention Resistance, more information will be found at detentionresistance.org. They're entirely grassroots, donation-based, all-volunteer group, primarily women who involved with running the group, and have been consistent through and through, now going over 5 years strong.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Dr. Roberto Hernandez, Associate Professor of Chicano Studies at San Diego State University, who is speaking on a variety of issues ranging from how the federal Title 42 program is being used to expel indigenous and non-indigenous asylees and political refugees, plus a lot more. That concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest, Dr. Roberto Hernandez. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
And for the innocent, you can't justify why your freedom manifests on their graves. And the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains. That must be heard. After all the lies and the empty promises, we take a stand on the land that you tried to bury us. For all the pain and all the suffering, we take a stand. We take a stand. We sleep caged against our fears. What we've been told, wearing our souls on a thread. The moment of silence is over.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.